So I'm going to be giving actually a fairly general talk that will relate to polar mid-latitude interactions, but is not specifically on that, although you'll see there's a number of connections once we get it up. Probably because I'm not a polar person, so I'm just going to talk about uncertainty in general connected with the atmospheric circulation. And if you want a bit more background on some of the ideas I'll be talking about here, I just published recently a perspective in Nature Geoscience, and the bottom line is basically everything that we have confidence in about climate change is pretty much thermodynamic, and when it comes to dynamic aspects which involve circulation, it's very hard for us to say anything with confidence. So talk about some of the issues there. So the thing that Libby's already mentioned, we have this tremendous variability. That this is the example of the NAO. Is that okay? This is the example of the NAO, where you have a nice 100-year time series, but pretty much any dynamical quantity that you pick, any circulation feature, has these ups and downs, and you'd be crazy to attach any trends to it. I mean, there was, because you can get what appear to be a significant trends over 40 to 50 years by our normal significance tests. You know, this is probably 4 sigma trend or something if you just take this little piece of the puzzle. And I think, you know, you just have to be very careful. So even this, I guess Jennifer's arguing that this decrease in the NAO now is the real anthropogenic signal, but 10 years ago people thought it was going the other way. So another thing that Louis also talked about is the fact that this variability will really dominate over multi-decadal trends and models. So this is from Deserts et al. Paper, just to show that these are PDFs from a single model, but I think a 40-member ensemble of 55-year, it's a pretty long time. We would generally say that 55 years is long enough to get a trend, or you would think so. But if you just look at, this is a winter time over the Eurasian North Atlantic sector, the gray is control run, so it's got a zero trend within noise, and then of the average, and then the red is a climate change. And precipitation, you can see that these PDFs are strongly overlapping, that they're distinct. There is a real change here in terms of the model. It's just that you need a large ensemble to get it. Huge contrast with surface temperature, which is shown over here, which, you know, you only need a single realization, and sea level pressure, which is a measure of the circulations. The point is that precipitation, at least at middle latitudes, is much more dynamically controlled than thermodynamically controlled. Having said that, if you look at the wings of this, not even the extremes, just the wings of this distribution, the sort of moderate extremes, you see that there's a big difference, maybe a factor of 2, in the risk. So just because a change is within one standard deviation of the variability doesn't mean it doesn't matter. This gets back to the significance point. There's a difference between statistical and real. I mean, this would have a huge impact on extremes, on risk. Hawkins and Sutton talked about the three components of variability. So the one that we haven't there. So there's internal variability, model uncertainty, and scenario uncertainty. If you look at the temperature, it's at the end of the century, it's dominated by scenario uncertainty. But for precipitation, this is DJF, you see that actually the confidence gets stalled by the model uncertainty. So basically, there's a lot of uncertainty about the models, which begin. Even once you've got away from the internal variability, now you've got the other problem of the fact that the models don't agree with each other. Now, there's been a belief that the storm tracks will shift poleward under climate change, and as Libby's already said, there's a lot of duplication here, I'm afraid. The wintertime North Atlantic seems different. This is a paper by Giuseppe Zappa at Reading. If you look at the climatology of the storm track density, it's actually three tracks in a way. There's the two tracks of the North Atlantic, and then there's the Mediterranean storm track. And the mean CMIP-5 response is actually, if you like, a focusing over Britain, which is where I've just moved to, which is great. But so actually, you could almost argue that there's been a push poleward from the south and a push equatorward from the north. So perhaps both are somehow true. Now, this is storm tracks, not jet per se. But of course, the models have large systematic biases. So here's the response that I just shown on the previous plot. This is the bias, and you can see that the color scale is expanded by 4. So the bias is 4 times as big as the mean bias, not individual models. The mean bias is 4 times as big as the signal that we're looking for. So, you know, bias correction, you got to really, really think carefully about whether this is even possible. Actually, this, again, Libby talked about this maybe from a different point of view. There's been a Spark Dynevor analysis led by Lisa Manzini, where they try to separate the different contributions to the Arctic sea level change. And we've already heard about the tropical warming, the tropical upper tropospheric warming, and the Arctic lower tropospheric warming. Another factor, actually, is the stratosphere, which also plays a role, of course, as we know, in the surface. And so they posit these as three independent drivers. No one yet really knows the mechanism for the stratospheric warming. It's obviously a strengthened Bredow-Dobson circulation, but exactly how isn't clear in terms of the polar part of it. But the models seem to show that reasonably. And you see that the tropical warming, as we expect, would drives a deepening of that low and a polarward shift. This is Greenwich's, by the way, is on the vertical here at the bottom. The Arctic pushes things back the other way, as we've seen, sort of like a negative NAO, as we've heard. And the stratosphere also acts like the Arctic warming, pushing it back with a negative NAO. So actually, you got a tug of war with three actors, perhaps, two of which are pushing in the same direction and one in the other direction. And just to say that the stratospheric part is the same as you see after stratospheric sudden warming, so it's consistent with that mechanism. Michael Sigmund and John Sonoka had a paper where they got the same effect, but by changes in the climatology of the jet induced through gravity drag. But it was basically the same kind of effect that if the stratospheric warms under climate change, it'll the vortex, it'll push the jet equatorward, and also Adam Scape. So different kinds of studies using different setups all point to the same thing. Oops. Okay. And then, of course, what complicates things is that there's a connection between the circulation response to forcing and variability. So it isn't just that we have variability on top of the response. There's a connection between them. And this is a paper by Clara Desert 10 years ago, which points this out clearly. This is the 500 hectopascal geopotential height response to idealized forcings, either of the sea surface temperature in the North Atlantic or ice here in the Arctic and North Atlantic regions. You see that the total response of the model is very similar between these two forcings. Then she projects part of that onto the modes of variability. Not to say that this is variability, just that the response to forcing projects on the modes of variability. When you take that part out, then you're left with a residual, and she interprets this as a direct baroclinic response, which is localized over the forcing, and then an indirect barotropic response, which projects on the modes of variability. And this is what you expect. There's something called the fluctuation dissipation theorem, and this is my simple version of it. It's not quite like tau squared, because it's more like a random walk than a real spring. But basically, the basic physics is that the modes of variability behave like a damped spring. The spring constant reflects internal dynamical feedbacks, like the eddy momentum fluxes and so on. The long-term variations reflect changes in forcing. If you apply a force to this damped spring, what you get is a response which is longer for a longer time scale. So basically, it's like if you have a longer time scale of variability, it's like a slacker spring. It responds more to a given forcing. As I say, this is formalized in the fluctuation dissipation theorem. It's not yet clear if it's really applicable. Formally, it's not applicable, but the basic physics seems right. There's a lot of it, you know, it makes sense that the modes of variability tell us about the feedbacks, which should tell us about the response to forcing. So it ties in, I think, with this idea of an indirect response that Desert talked about. One of the recent pieces of evidence for the fluctuation dissipation theorem is a recent study by Garfinkel, Wong, and Gerber, where they look at the effect of us. This is in this case a stronger stratospheric vortex, which will move the surface jet poleward, and they look at how that depends on the state of the on the location of the tropospheric jet. So it's a state dependent effect, the same nonlinearity. You can interpret this in terms of what Libby said is nonlinearity, because you could imagine that the greenhouse gas warming might move the jet, and that means that the response of the stratosphere would be different too, so it's got implications. This just shows that the change in the jet latitude, either in the upper troposphere or the lower troposphere, depends very sensitively on the latitude of the jet, and they argue this is just to do with the strength of the eddy feedback, so it's consistent with the fluctuation dissipation theorem. And they and another piece of evidence, this is from Yang Chen and Alan Plum, what they did here was they varied the time scale of the angular mode through the surface drag, but keeping the same jet latitude. So basically, what they find is that the amplitude of the response to a given forcing is proportional to the time scale. So this depends on the surface drag. Now that's possibly a concern because models satisfy their momentum balance in very different ways. So this is an example from a WIGNI. We haven't heard much in terms of acronyms, and I won't even spell out what a WIGNI is, but it's a working group between the World Weather Research Program and the World Climate Research Program. They have a surface drag project they've been working on. They haven't published, I guess, a paper yet, but they've got a report led by Ayrton Zadra. And what they've done is compute the different contributions to the momentum balance. And this just shows the boundary layer contribution to the surface torque and the subgrid scale orography contribution to the surface torque. You can see they vary by a lot. And a model that many people feel is the best in the world, ESMWF, is a huge outlier here. So it's a very interesting study, and we have to think about all this. So I was going to talk about the Southern Hemisphere, but I've run out of time. But just to say quickly, this is work from Isla Simpson when she was in my group, and this timescale bias then could be quite important. There's a big timescale bias in the Southern Hemisphere in models. A lot of it comes from the stratosphere, and you can show that with a model where the stratosphere variability is damped. But there's still a bias without the stratospheric effect, and maybe skip. Well, actually, Kinston and Gerber had argued the bias was linked to the jet latitude, but I think we showed that that wasn't true, and again, it's an example that you can't rely on correlations. Correlations do not establish causality. They may just be responding to the same thing. And she found that actually planetary wave 3 was an important played an important role in damping the annular mode, and that was deficient in all the CMIP-5 models. So just the questions I'd like to finish with, do model biases matter for projections? In the thermodynamic world, we tend to assume not. People just zero things out and don't worry about it, but it seems like it's potentially much more of an issue for circulation. And just to say, there may be biases in processes that are not apparent in the climatologies because of compensating errors like surface drag, but biases, of course, may show up in the variability. Can we relate the biases to uncertainty in the projections, these so-called emergent constraints? Not much success so far in terms of circulation. Can we bias correct the model of projections? Can we use the fluctuation dissipation theorem quantitatively and more generally, even if the FDP isn't exactly true? What does the internal variability tell us about the response to forcing?